is the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, and a historic announcement this morning that we, being the United States, China, Russia, France, and the United Kingdom, have come to an agreement, and the United States, have come to an agreement with Iran. And this is a huge, huge deal. And I wanted to get a real Iran expert on here, and a political expert as well, somebody who knows the politics of both sides of the aisle, and really understands how Washington, D.C. works, to talk about where this is going to go. Former Congressman Bob Ney represented Ohio, the 18th Congressional District, as a Republican in the House of Representatives. He's a journalist. He's the author of the book Sideswiped, Lessons Learned Courtesy of the Hitmen of Capitol Hill. And he was the only member of Congress, and I'm guessing that's still the case today, although he's not in Congress any longer, who speaks Farsi, who understands Iran, who has been to Iran, who speaks the language of Iran, which is Farsi. So Bob Ney, Congressman, welcome back.
Thank you, Tom. How are you?
Well, do we have you?
Hello? Yes.
There we go. Okay.
Yeah. Hi, how are you?
Hi, Bob. I'm fine. Just to start out, you want to give us a little backstory on this?
Sure. First of all, this deal could have occurred 10 years ago. There was a legitimate offer at that time when you had President Khatami, who was a moderate, before Ahmadinejad, who was not a moderate. And this deal was offered, the beginnings of these types of deals, was offered to the Bush administration, which they summarily objected to, and in fact denied they ever had it until they admitted it later. So I did want to give you that backstory.
Right, and that came through you.
It came, yes, from Ambassador Guleman of Switzerland, who came from Tehran. He's ambassador from Switzerland, came into the office and said, I have this amazing beginning, and as this deal is a beginning of what President Obama has negotiated with the other countries, and it was sent to the White House, which upon they denied it. In fact, the late Tony Snow said, look where Bob Ney's at. He was referring to my time headed to federal prison at that time. And they denied what they later had to admit. Yes, they had received that agreement with inspectors on the ground, our American inspectors, way back when. So this was the beginning, which, again, was, I wanted to point out, rejected because it was tweeted today. This could have occurred 10 years ago. So now, over periods of years, there have been conversations of mutual interest on a bipartisan basis with members of Congress, and not directly with the Iranian government, but with representatives, and accumulated into around 2009, the beginnings of conversations. And, of course, the phone call from our president to the new president of Iran, Rouhani, who seemed to want a different path. And that led to today's arrangement. Now, again, you know, we're not alone in this, and we keep hearing Iran and America, but as you pointed out, there's Iran and six major nations, and then there's a deal that was implemented in this, in which case this has to go through the UN with a set-up procedure of monitoring, which will stay, Tom, like that for the next decade and more. And this will have an immediate countdown, and they call it a 90-day implementation. And Iran then has to have the International Atomic Inspection Agency to certify that it's complying with taking apart basically the centrifuge, with dismantling. Now, after that point in time, once that's certified, seven international sanctions from the UN will be lifted on Iran. That part has a downside from our point of view, because we didn't want the seventh, one of the seven sanctions of arms embargo to be undone. Now, the Saudis in particular are moving arms, but the Saudis didn't want the Iranians to, you know, to counter them in certain areas such as Yemen. So there's some intrigue. That's what the Saudi point of view is. Israel's point of view is a bit different. They live in the region and they have some concerns over past verbiage from Iran and their future. But with Saudi Arabia, it's about oil and money, because Iran, after these sanctions are lifted, Tom, they come back into the world community. And as an Iranian woman, private message today from Tehran, who has no political dog in this hunt, said, we're crying tears for our potential ability to have joy of freedom in Iran. So there's a lot of people that that want that.
Right.
Now, the Congress itself has 60 days to review, and you will have, you know, John McCain and John Boehner, et cetera, will tell you this is the end of the world. They themselves crafted a resolution, I would note, not crafted by President Obama, but their own resolution, to only give themselves 60 days. And, Tom, a lot of people know that it would be hard for them to find the restroom and agree upon that in 60 days in that controlled Congress.
On the other hand, that's 60 days where an enormous amount of money can flow into this country from Saudi Arabia and Israel running ads with, you know, what sound like American organizations sponsoring the ads, trashing the deal, right?
Oh, absolutely. If you look at some of the ads that features Rubio on it, which almost is a campaign violation of sorts, you know, he's the only one that can stand up as supporting his presidency. There will be money flowing unprecedented. And I will also note, remember, too, people have to remember, big oil is not going to be happy with this, because more oil into the market, which allows us to have cheaper prices, is not a goal of big oil.
Right.
So Iran coming into this is nothing that the big financiers of Wall Street are going to be doing cartwheels over.
Right.
There's going to be a ton of money to try to stop.
In fact, the price of oil dropped today. I'm curious about the Republican Party on this, Bob. You were a Republican congressman. I'm reading in the Christian Science Monitor, and you're familiar with this article.
Yes.
This is former President Bonnie Sauter. He was elected in the middle of in August of 1980. He was deposed a year later in 1981. And he says, after arriving in France, I told a BBC reporter that I had left Iran to expose the symbiotic relationship between Khomeiniism and Reaganism. I had told Khomeini and Ronald Reagan had organized a clandestine negotiation, later known as the October Surprise, which prevented the attempts by myself and then U.S. President Jimmy Carter to free the hostages before the 1980 U.S. presidential election took place. The fact that they were not released tipped the results of the election in favor of Reagan. End of quote from the president of Iran. Now, there's got to be a lot of documentation of this floating around inside Iran. And I'm wondering if the Republican Party just really doesn't want any of that to ever see the light of day. And that's why they've been fighting this so long.
Well, we know that people went to Tehran with cakes, literally cakes, mm-hmm. or goodwill gestures. We know that there was a deal with arms, the Iran-Contra.
Yeah.
I mean, that was negotiated. That wasn't where Iran, you know, telepathically thought, okay, is this what you want to do, Mr. President? I mean, somebody had to negotiate those deals. We know that.
Right. It appears it was Bill Casey, actually.
Yes.
But
yes, these things happen. There's always been speculation about the fact of Jimmy Carter and the timing of the whole Iran situation and the release of the hostages. And then you have Bonnie Sauter, who's not, you know, a, quote, crazy maniac, who's a pretty legitimate, reasonable type of guy that has made these statements. So it makes a lot of people, you know, wonder, you know, what really is out there and
right.
what's happened.
Right. But you've never heard anybody in the Republican Party freaking out about this. It's just you and I are just speculating right now. Is that
right.
correct?
I've never heard anybody freaking out about it, but I do know that that huge money. This isn't just about, you know, philosophy, et cetera.
Right.
Huge money will come into this because for the oil barons.
Right. Do you think that we're just about out of time. Do you think that the Republicans are also opposed to this because they're simply opposed to anything that might enhance Obama's legacy?
Well, that's the other thing. This is Nobel Peace Prize for Kerry and Zarif, the two negotiators.
Right.
Potential. But I think a lot of Republicans fear Obama getting a major recognized world win.
Yeah, I agree with you. Bob Ney, former Congressman Bob Ney, author of the absolutely brilliant book. You got to read it. It's called Sideswipe, Lessons Learned Courtesy of the Hitmen on Capitol Hill. Bob, thanks so much for being with us today. Good talking with you. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
15 minutes past the hour. Anything goes summer. Got some interesting news about inequality and Hillary and all kinds of cool stuff. Stick around. Welcome back. 15 minutes past the hour. Michael watching Free Speech TV in Zephyr Hills, Florida on the Dish Network. Hey, Michael, what's up?
Yes, I have my question is a political question. It's about will this, if Hillary or Bernie, whoever happens to be the Democrat nominee, if they agree with this decision, will they lose a good percentage of the Jewish vote?
I don't know. I know that in the United States, that's a good question. Bernie has already come out and endorsed this deal. He issued a press release this morning. I haven't seen anything from Hillary Clinton's office, but maybe I'm not on her mailing list. I don't know. I should make an effort to get on it. I don't think that the Jewish vote in the United States is as monolithic as many people would think. You know, there are a lot of Jews who are, right or wrong, no matter what, Israel is, we totally support. And then there are a lot of Jews in America who are, have a very nuanced view of it. And there are many who probably don't much care one way or the other, who are just living their lives and doing their business. So, or making a living or whatever. So I doubt it. I really doubt it. I think that the Republican opposition is not coming from a place of legitimate disagreement with the deal. I think it's coming out of a place of that the Republicans do not want Barack Obama, the first black president of the United States, to have any kind of consequential legacy. That's why they tried to destroy his Affordable Care Act. And Scott Walker came out yesterday and said if he becomes president, the first thing he'll do is repeal it, which is repealing, the largest part of Obama's domestic legacy. And Cuba's a big deal, but this is huge. This would be the biggest part of his foreign policy legacy. And, Bob is right. This is Nobel Peace Prize stuff, for the Iranian foreign minister and for John Kerry. It's just, yeoman's work and maybe for the other five countries involved. So I don't think so, Michael. We'll see. We'll see. Michael, thanks a lot for the call. Don in St. Petersburg, Florida. Hey, Don, what's up? Thanks for watching Free Speech on Dish.
Yeah, and thanks for getting me addicted to your show where I don't get a lot of work done sometimes.
Sorry about that, Don.
The reason I'm calling is you mentioned the other day about Bush charging $100,000 to veterans.
A wounded veterans group, yes, to make a speech for them.
The rest of the story is that he charged $20,000 additional for round trip plane fare, and Laura Bush charged $50,000 for her speech. And Clinton, even though he commands sometimes $500,000 for speeches, he doesn't charge veterans anything. And this story broke the night before on ABC News, Worldwide News, before you mentioned it.
Yeah.
And they ran this story, they asked this story to a veteran who had no arms. His arms were blown off in a wreck. He had two metal contraptions.
Right. Don, we're out of time, but I agree with you. I think it's reprehensible. And thank you very much for the call. We'll be right back. Welcome back. 20 minutes past the hour. Bernie Sanders has issued a press release publicly and aggressively supporting the Iran deal that the president, that John Kerry and the Obama administration helped, along with Russia, China, France, and Germany, and England, put together. And, a fine thing it is. And Hillary Clinton's campaign has issued a statement saying that they are supportive of the deal. They're congratulating the Obama administration on, work well done sort of thing. So meanwhile, the Republicans are climbing over each other to be increasingly hyperbolic and hysterical about this. And I think, Bob Day nailed it. There's big money here. If Iran comes into the world market with their oil, it's going to further depress the price of oil. The price of oil dropped this morning on news that the deal had happened. The fossil fuel industry doesn't like that. And, so there's money for members of Congress there. Israel's unhappy with this. There's money for members of Congress there. Saudi Arabia is unhappy about this, as well as several of the other Sunni dictatorships in the region. And, they're all multi-billionaires. So there's money for members of Congress there. So I think you're going to see, you know, the bought and paid for shills for the fossil fuel industry in particular in the U.S. Senate and the House of Representatives on the Republican side and a few on the Democratic side who are, you know, going to just, you know, be ringing the hysterical buttons and bells and whatever they can do. I mean, I saw Tom Cotton this morning on TV, you know, saying, this is no good. This is he was the guy, the leader of the 47 traitors who sent the letter to Iran's president saying, you know, we have a final say in this. Well, they don't. They have this is a deal between Iran and the United Nations, not Iran and the United States. Now, the U.S. part of it, the U.S. Congress can and almost certainly will pass you know, legislation or whatever you want to call it, saying, no, we don't go along with this. The president will veto it, which means that they're going to have to marshal two-thirds of the House and the Senate in order to survive a presidential veto, which means they're going to need a lot of Democrats. And I don't think the Democrats are going to be there for it, you know, unless in the next 2 months, and keep in mind, in the world of politics, I mean, 2 days is an eternity. 2 months is you know, an eon, an epoch. And if in the next 2 months the people who are opposed to this deal manage to roll out some horrible thing, you know, the equivalent of when the daughter of the Kuwaiti ambassador went before Congress in 1991 and lied, saying that she was a nurse working in a hospital in Kuwait, and that she had seen the Iraqi soldiers come in and throw babies out of the what do you call them, incubators? Is that the word for preemies, and steal the incubators? Well, it was a complete lie. It was totally made up. And she had been coached by a PR firm here in the United States, which had been hired by the government of Kuwait because they wanted America to go in and kick Saddam Hussein out of Kuwait. And sure enough, you know, U.S. public opinion turned based on, in large part on that testimony. You know, these people are such barbarians, they're throwing babies on the floor. Again, it was a lie. She was never held to account for lying to Congress. And George Herbert Walker Bush was able to have his war, which he thought was going to get him reelected. It didn't quite work out that way, as his son pointed out back in 1999 when he said, my daddy had all this political capital and he wasted it. Why? Yeah, well, the war only lasted 100 hours. George Herbert Walker Bush, having been a survivor of World War II, where he flew bombing missions, was actually very proud of the fact that his war was a very short war, you know, with a relatively minimal number of casualties and no long-term consequences. At least that's how it looked at the time. We know now that had they listened to Bernie Sanders, who stood on the floor of the House of Representatives in 1991 and outspokenly said, we should not invade Kuwait. This is their problem, not our problem. There are other Arab countries in the region that have big armies. If they think that, you know, one Arab country is messing with another Arab country in an inappropriate way, you've got the Arab League can deal with this. This is not our problem. We should not be invading Kuwait. This will set up wars in the future with Iraq and in the region. This is what Bernie Sanders said. I'm paraphrasing, of course. This is what Bernie Sanders said in 1991. You can find the video on YouTube. It's fairly easy to find. On the floor of the House of Representatives, he warned us. And sure enough, that first Bush war set the stage for the second, you know, Shrubs war, and, you know, which is still haunting us. Still haunting us. I wanted to talk a little bit about fundraising and inequality, and then we'll pick up your calls right after the bottom of the hour here, if anything goes summer. But here's what the campaigns for the various candidates for public office have raised so far. Now, this is where people have actually made contributions to the official campaign. These contributions are capped at, I think it's $2,700, it might be $2,400, $2,800, thank you, Shano, $2,800 per person per year, okay? Hillary Clinton has taken in $45 million. Bernie Sanders has taken in $15 million. Marco Rubio has taken in $12 million. Jeb Bush, $11 million. Ben Carson, $10 million. Ted Cruz, $10 million. Rand Paul, $7 million. Carly Fiorina, $1 million. Rick Perry, $1 million. And Lincoln Chafee, $390,000. Now, all of them actually have a lot more money than that available to them, except for Bernie Sanders, because all of them have super PACs. Bush's super PAC has an additional $103 million. Cruz's super PAC has an additional $37 million. Rick Perry has an additional $16 million in his super PAC. Rubio has an additional $16 million in his super PAC. And then there's another super PAC for Rubio that's got another almost $16 million. Clinton has a $15 million super PAC, a $7 million super PAC, and a $1 million super PAC. Carly has a $3.4 million super PAC, and John Kasich has $11 million in his super PAC. So the super PACs, of course, are dark money from very wealthy people. And this is the cancer in our democracy. This is the absolute cancer in our democracy, which is leading to this incredible explosion of inequality. We will be back with your calls right after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
It's Anything Goes Summer here on the Tom Hartman Program. We'll be right back on this Tuesday. Very Hercynely Ugly, the good. Hawaii, the Pacific Island state, is testing a new wave energy system to generate electricity. The device is called Azura. And unlike other systems that generate electricity from the waves, this system is the first device that generates electricity from moving both up and down and side to side with the waves. Hawaii's reliance on imported fossil fuels is a lot of the reason that that state has the highest electricity costs in the country. The Azura system will be tested for the next year, and then the state plans to expand the system for up to 1 megawatt of electricity for commercial use. There's no doubt that it's time to move away from dirty fossil fuels, and it just makes sense that we tap into the natural motion of the Earth's oceans to power a clean and renewable future. The bad. Doug McElwee, the Fox so-called news contributor, delivered a special report about the ongoing controversy over the Confederate flag and Southern heritage. The report was mostly mundane infotainment, a few sound bites of congressmen, and some comparisons to censorship in the Soviet Union. But the report ended with some interesting speculation about the U.S. Capitol building. Take a look. Or listen.
So what to ban next? Well, critics fear an overreaction. Would you, for example, remove this statue? That is Will Rogers. He's Oklahoma's favorite native son. He was also an unabashed admirer of the Italian dictator Benito Mussolini. Or would you ban this building itself, the United States Capitol, which is here only because of the back-breaking labor of African-American slaves?
There you have it. In the bizarre world of Fox reporting, banning Robert E. Lee's battle flag from public spaces is just one step away from tearing down the U.S. Capitol building. And the very, very ugly, Donald Trump. So far, the Donald's campaign has been sticking to a platform of anti-China trade policies and anti-immigrant nativism. But on Friday night, according to the L.A. Weekly, Trump told an audience that we never should have invaded Iraq. He continues his foray into reason by saying that we needed Iraq as a stable buffer against Iran in the region. And then his reason jumped the shark again when he said that we should have invaded Mexico instead. That sounds crazy now, but maybe the Bush administration can help invent some evidence that Mexico's developing WMDs? Just a joke. This type of insanity is normal for Trump, but the fact that he's a top-tier Republican candidate, that is very, very ugly. John, in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Hey, John, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, I just wanted to say, you know, also, there isn't monolithic support for Netanyahu within the state of Israel.
You're saying this in the context of Netanyahu's opposition to this deal between Iran and the P5 plus one, right?
Right.
Okay.
And, you know, I think he's just a big saber rattler, and I think that the military-industrial complex gives him a lot of perks, and the people on our side in this country, they like to use him. And I think he plays into the fears of Israelis, you know, because they're surrounded by hostile elements. But he is really far, far right. And,
yeah.
You know, there are political parties in Israel that are, you know, just as much in opposition to him as maybe even the Palestinians are. So, you know, I think he gains a lot from being involved in the military-industrial complex, and maybe he even gets some kickbacks and money from it, because, you know, that's what they're all about, people like Cheney, people, you know, these people that are pushing this
I think that's
neocon,
a lot, you know,
or running our foreign policy in that way, because we build more nuclear bombs, we build more, you know, we spend more money on armaments, and they make a lot of money, but, yeah. You know, the world suffers because you know,
well, we know that was the case with Dick Cheney. He went in, he came into office. Halliburton was nearly bankrupt in 2000. In 2000, because he had acquired Dresser Industries, and which had this huge liability, asbestos liability, and he was betting that the government was going to take that liability off their back, and it didn't.
Right.
And you know, so when he came into office, he had all this stock in Halliburton, which was pretty much worthless. And all of a sudden, Halliburton gets all these no-bid contracts and becomes one of the biggest corporations in the world. I don't know that that's the case with Netanyahu. I don't, you know, I think that speculating about his personal motives is probably not a wise thing. I think, though, that politically, Netanyahu has built a career out of saber rattling, and the fact of the matter is, he's never gotten a majority in any election. He has to form a government with you know, a whole bunch of smaller parties, because he only gets 30-40% of the vote, and although that's more than anybody else got. And
right.
And you're right. You know, read Haaretz, you know, the kind of left-wing newspaper, as opposed to the Jerusalem Post, the right-wing newspaper. They're both online. You can read them both, and you'll get very different opinions. And there's a spirited debate in Israel about everything from what should be done about the West Bank to the Gaza to the settlements, to Palestinians as Israeli citizens. To I mean, you know, it just goes on and on and on. And I'm sure that there's a spirited debate in Israel about Iran, and there's a lot less, oddly enough, a lot less demagoguery around these issues, at least my read of it, and having spent a fair amount of time in Israel in my life, a lot less demagoguery there than there is here. And I think that's because it's a small country. Everybody knows each other. The media is, you know, pretty straightforward. And whereas here, if somebody just comes in with, you know, a couple $100 million and buys a whole bunch of TV advertising, you can just flip public opinion in any crazy way you want. But yeah, you're right. You're absolutely right, John. Thanks a lot for the call. Great to hear from you. Ann in Gold Canyon, Arizona. Hey, Ann, what's up? Thanks for listening to 1480 AM.
Well, thank you. I am reading, Tom, I'm reading Article 2, Section 1 from the Constitution.
Right.
And it says, no person except a natural-born citizen or a citizen of the United States at the time of the adoption of this Constitution shall be eligible to the office of president.
Right.
So my question is, how come Ted Cruz is running for president and nobody on either party has ever mentioned that he is not eligible to be president?
Because he was born in Canada and his father was Cuban.
Right.
His mother was American.
I know, but he's
right.
Not eligible.
Right. Here's the problem, Ann. We've had five presidents, I believe, if I recall correctly, it might be six, who have had parents who are not citizens or who have been born outside the United States or you know, variations on that. And it's really never come up. It only came up when a black man ran for president. And he's not really an American. He's a Kenyan or whatever. It's just code for, hey, have you noticed that this guy's black? The reason Ted Cruz can run for president and nobody's going to question his bona fides is that he's essentially a white guy. And so, you know, and he's a right winger, and it was only the right wing that was all hysterical about this. The phrase natural born citizen has never been litigated and has never been clearly defined. So nobody knows exactly what that means. And, you know, the assumption is, you know, a legitimate citizen of the United States. The concern when they were writing the Constitution was that you didn't want somebody who was president who might have secret loyalties to other countries. There was a lot of concern about that with regard to both England and France. And in fact, it was a very divisive issue in some of the early debates on the Constitution. But it's never been tested. So So the bottom line is that it's only the right wing that seems to worry about natural-born citizens, and they only seem to worry about it when the person running for president has a little more pigment in his skin than Ted Cruz has. And that's why we haven't heard a peep from anybody. And thank you for the call. Charles in Opa-locka, Florida. Hey, Charles, what's up?
Hi, good morning. Good afternoon, Tom. Hey. I spoke to you a couple months ago, and I just said that I just thought that corporate oil had too much influence on our politics, especially in the Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as that I saw this morning that the deal had been reached, I noticed that oil started to drop.
Right. It's because Iran is a major supplier of oil, and when the embargo stops, their oil is going to be dumped on world markets, which is a good thing, I think, frankly, because it'll further depress the price of oil. Well, you could argue that's a bad thing too. You know, a high price of oil is good for renewables, but whatever. The other thing is that some of Iran's oil right now, because of the embargo, is making its way into black markets and ending up in places like Syria, and not sure that's such a good thing.
Right, but, you know, the bad thing is that it's enveloping our politics. You know, you have to think about the fact that they actually want to consider war, or just saber, you know, whether they're just saber rattling or not.
Right.
Who's
the they you're talking about, Charles?
Well, I'm talking about the conservatives.
Oh, you know, yeah. Lindsey Graham came out this morning and said this is a declaration of war on Israel. I mean, that's so over the top, so hyperbolic. This is going to guarantee the security of Israel. But, you know.
Right, but once they do that, what I mean is they take money away. They want to take money away from job programs. They want to take money from food stamps and send it to the military complex.
Right.
You know, and this is what's... This is the biggest problem now that we're facing. We need to stop them in their tracks. You know, what we've done, we've made progress. I actually believe that Bernie has a chance to win, only because progressives, we care more about everyone, and we want this world to do better.
I agree. And on the other hand, Hillary is moving more and more in a progressive direction also. I think either one of them has the potential to be the next FDR. And I'm really pleased to see it all happening. Charles, thanks a lot for the call. It's 15 minutes before the hour. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Anything goes summer. Your calls, my news of the day, and my thoughts coming up right after this. And welcome back. Jesse in Miami, Florida. Hey, Jesse, what's up? Thanks for watching Free Speech TV.
Hey, hi, Tom. Thanks for being there.
Sure.
Hey, Tom, I remember some years back you was in Spain at that Mondragon cooperative.
Yeah, I was. I wrote a chapter about it in my book, Threshold. Yep.
Okay. Well, three quick questions, very relevant to today's news.
Mm-hmm.
Do the cooperative realize that the pursuit of profit is unsustainable? That's one. Number two.
Well, let's take these one at a time, Jesse. Yes, they do. The any profits that the cooperative makes are either distributed to its members as wages, or are invested in growth. And the Mondragon co-op now is, I think it's $30, $40 billion. I mean, it's a huge enterprise worldwide with all kinds of affiliates all over the place. And the CEO makes four times what the lowest paid janitor makes.
How do they determine that? And
By democratic process. It is
that's good.
By democratic process. I'll tell you a story, Jesse, about you know, Louise and I were there, and we were in a factory where they were making washing machines in Mondragon in Spain, and we were up above the factory floor. There's like a catwalk where you can walk around and look down on the factory floor, and we were watching these folks at the station, and somebody wearing a white coat with a clipboard comes up to the four people who were working at this particular station, and they have this long conversation. And they're pointing at things and whatnot, and then that person leaves. And I said, "What happened?" And our translator said, "The woman with the white coat and the pad is from management, and she came to talk, and they're going to change the way that the assembly line is working. They're trying to make it more efficient, and she came to talk to the workers. And I said, oh, so she came to tell them how they were going to make the changes? And she said, no, she came to ask them their advice on how to make the changes. It's pretty amazing. Back to you,
hey,
Jesse.
I have one question. If somebody found the cure to cancer or something, how would what would happen? Would they get the patent? What would they do? How to reward that person? Well, we know the failure of communism. You know, yeah. A good idea gets stolen by the party, and they benefit, and the workers just keep on working. So, how can we avoid that mistake? What do the Spanish cooperative do to avoid that mistake? Because
I don't know that they're
a moneyless economy. I think you know we all have to feel that we a benefit from our ideas.
Yeah, I don't know if Mondragon is involved in medicine at all. You know, if you want to look at medical advances and, you know, in a non-capitalist economic scenario, you should check out Cuba. They've just done amazing things with medicine, and they've developed, you know, vaccines and medications that are not even available in the United States. There have been drugs developed that do cure cancer. My wife took one of them, and it's very specific to the type of breast cancer that she had, and it cost $100,000. And you know, thank God we had insurance. But it's patented, and that's why it cost $100,000. It probably cost $65 to manufacture, but you know, they've got the patent, so that pharmaceutical company. So you know, that's the kind of thing that happens in a capitalist society. On the other hand, you know, they had an incentive to develop it. So, you know, that's I'm not anti-capitalist, Jesse. I think regulated capitalism works better than nothing. Jesse, thanks a lot for the call. It's always nice talking with you. It's 10 minutes before the hour. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And John in Jeffersonville, Ohio. Hey, John, you wanted to talk about the circular firing squad?
Yeah, I find myself today agreeing with you, but it's like this thing keeps coming up with me. On the one hand, if we don't do anything, in other words, if there's no expense or there's no cost to politicians to vote corporatist, then he just continues to do it, and there's no downside. Okay, I understand it this time with the Supreme Court justices we've got up there. I am a wholeheartedly in agreement with you on that. But at some point, don't we need the Republicans have moved the country to the right simply because they've gotten rid of all the rhinos. They're more pure. And I don't know. It just seems like we need talk me down.
I think that there's a progressive wave that is sweeping across the Democratic Party and America, frankly, right now. I think the conservatives are in retreat. We'll see how this goes. But if you're talking about, for example, my saying that I'm not going to let this program become a bash Hillary program or a bash any Democrat program. That doesn't mean that I'm not willing to talk about the issues. For example, Bernie Sanders has come out very strongly in favor of reinstating Glass-Steagall. To the best of my knowledge, Hillary Clinton has not issued a statement on that, which, you know, seems to me like a mistake. I think that, you know, she should be enthusiastic about it. But I may be wrong on that, too. So, I've got to do a better job of getting on her mailing list and getting all the information from the Hillary campaign. But, you know, there's nothing wrong with having these conversations. What's the problem is when people just come on and just start trashing people. It's not healthy. You know, so
right. No, I respect you for that. And talking about the atoms, the actual issues is the key to the whole thing. Because if we, the majority of the American public, I talk to Republicans all the time. And if I go issue by issue by issue, they fall into line. They agree with me.
You're right. You're right. By the way, I don't know if you noticed, but you know the meme is out there that Hillary's in the pocket of the banksters because they're, you know, if you look on Open Secrets, it shows that the big banks is her largest contributors. But it's not actually the banks who are contributing. It's their employees. And these big banks are based in New York State, which is her home state. And so they have a maximum of $2,700 per person. So it's really not a seriously legitimate criticism, I don't think. And Hillary came out, 2 days ago, and said it's time for banksters basically to go to jail if they're committing crimes, and which is a huge departure from the Obama administration, which has avoided indicting any individuals for crimes and has allowed instead corporations, banking corporations, to plead guilty to felonies. So, I see a lot of positive motion on the Democratic side of the ticket, and I'm very pleased by that. John, thanks a lot for the call. Alan in Glendale, California. Hey, Alan, what's up?
Well, hi, Tom. I think there is a wave of there's a wave of good things happening in the United States about that. But I see one problem with the Democrats. You know, they've never really, I'd say for 50 years or so, they've never embraced spiritualism or religion, which I think is essential to a lot of
Jimmy Carter did.
Yeah, Jimmy did. He did. But he kind of got, you know, he didn't really fit into Washington, if you remember right. You know?
Right. Yeah, he was an outsider.
He was definitely an outsider, and, you know, Ted Kennedy and, you know, later ran against him. They kind of didn't meet with people. He just kind of was secluded in his office.
Well, I don't know that that's the case. I thought Jimmy Carter ran a pretty good presidency.
I read about it.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was, though. He didn't have much dealings with Congress.
Oh, yeah. Anyway, same with Obama.
Yeah, same with Obama, yeah. And Obama actually reminds me of in terms of his temperament, he reminds me of Ronald Reagan. In terms of he's calm like Reagan was.
Mm. Although Reagan's calmness may have been dementia. No.
Yeah, possibly, yeah.
That's definitely not the case with Obama.
You may be right, but I saw Ronald Reagan in California when he was governor, and he had the same kind of demeanor as he did later.
Yeah.
Anyway, I think if the Democratic Party under, let's say, Bernie Sanders or Hillary Clinton, they look like the two most likely nominees. Mm. They need to go out there and talk about, I don't know about Bernie, and I don't know really about Hillary's religious beliefs. You know, I know Hillary goes to church and stuff, but I get a sense that
Hillary is a Southern Baptist. Her husband certainly was. And Bernie is a non-practicing Jew.
Right. That's what I understand about Bernie. But the Clintons, do you think they just use that for kind of, you know, so, like if you're not a Christian or even, you know, a Jewish person has never been elected to the presidency.
Right. Although we now have, I believe, 4 Jews on the Supreme Court, which is, Jews and 5 Catholics.
Back in the day, there was Frankfurter, there was 7. Louis, you know, Brandeis. And,
right.
So that's not new to this.
But my point is that I think that, you know, the wall, I think this started with John Kennedy. There had never been a Catholic president before either. I mean, America had basically been a country where WASPs held the power structure, white Anglo-Saxon Protestants, and right up until 1960. And Jack Kennedy became the first Catholic president. I think it's not inconceivable. Joe Lieberman wanted to be the first Jewish president. It's not inconceivable that Bernie Sanders could be the first Jewish president if he gets the nomination.
I totally agree with that. Yeah, I think people are kind of going past that.
And the thing is, he would, you know, he would. It's interesting because I think Bernie would get the vote of the people who are tired of all the hyper holier than thou ism that goes on, particularly on the Republican side. I mean, it's so interesting. In the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus explicitly said, you know, when you pray, do it in secret. When you give alms, do it in secret. Do your good deeds in secret, because, you know, if you do it in public, you're just doing it for your ego, basically. And the Republicans proclaim their piety over and over and over and over again in direct contradiction of the instructions from the founder of the faith, which is just amazing to me. Alan, thanks a lot for the call. We'll be back right after the news at the top of the hour. It's Anything Goes Summer, and I've got a few more stories here that I want to share with you, the news of the day, and also collecting your thoughts on politics, on the Iran deal, on all the stuff that's going on. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. This
is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. You know, there was a time in the United States when we had well-regulated capitalism. And from the 1930s to the 1980s, CEOs made 20 to 30 times what their most lowly paid employees made, at the most. And the middle class was growing and expanding. And this was the direct consequence. And, you know, industrial manufacturing was huge. This was the direct result of very specific tax policies, saying to CEOs, okay, after you make 30 times what your worker makes, you know, your income tax after that point is going to be 91% or 74% in the case of the 60s and 70s. And so instead of taking all that money, these CEOs just, you know, put it back in the business and kept it going. And I would say since the 1980s, we have had really unbridled capitalism, raw, naked capitalism in the United States. And the result has been that in virtually every industry, you now have just three or four companies. We're seeing this in the airline industry now. So the Pope speaks out about this, about the global need to move swiftly away from policies that are generating mass poverty, unparalleled inequality, and suffering. He said, let us not be afraid to say it. We want change, real change, structural change. As he blasted the system of unbridled capitalism across the planet that, quote, has imposed the mentality of profit at any price with no concern for social exclusion or the destruction of nature. So that's the Pope saying, wait a minute, unbridled capitalism, we need to re-regulate capitalism. On the flip side of that, speaking on behalf of unbridled capitalism, is Neil McCabe, political director of Gravis Insights, Florida-based pollster and columnist at townhall.com, gravisinsights.com, the website. Neil, welcome back.
Hey, glad to be with you, Tom.
So you want to trash the Pope, huh?
For 8 years, I was a reporter at Boston's Catholic paper, the Pilot. So
And you are Catholic yourself, right?
I'm not the best, but I try.
Okay. So,
but I follow this closely, and it's very disturbing how the Holy Father has sort of played his cards. I really believe in my heart of hearts that there are, you know, some of these translations and some of these things are being tilted to make it seem like the Pope is saying more than he's saying. It's certainly the case with his remarks with gun manufacturers, and I did pretty deep research on what he actually said and what he meant. And I think that, you know, the unbridled capitalism, unless he actually said that in English, I'm
he said it's the dung
Spanish.
Of the devil.
Right.
I mean, that's pretty unambiguous. You know.
There is something about, having a conscience and operating with a conscience and having your actions informed by the gospel of our Lord Jesus Christ and the teachings of his church. And so that would be the bridle. I think a lot of conservatives are concerned when that bridle on capitalism, rather than being an individual's conscience.
I think the bridle is that government establishes the rules of the game. Neil, here's a few of the realities right now that have come about as a result of Reaganism. And this was very much not the case in 1980. It very much is now. The amount of money that was given out in bonuses on Wall Street last year is twice the amount that all minimum wage workers in America combined earned. Every single minimum wage worker in America, if you added them all together, just the bonuses, not the paychecks, just the bonuses
But Wall Street bonuses, Tom, are based on deals. Basically, it's a commission on deals consummated, and it's just figured out at the end of the year.
It's a hustle. It's just wrong. Moving money around should not be that profitable, Neil. We need to go back to boring banking. The wealthiest 85 people on the planet have more money than the poorest 3.5 billion people.
I've made three trips to China, Tom. Okay, from 2006, my last trip is in 2013, and I have seen what poverty has been eradicated, what capitalism has done for these people.
Neil. That's state-run capitalism.
I've seen small families who have put together a little patch of land, who grow corn, who grow grapes. I mean, they people I've seen.
It's heavily regulated capitalism in China, Neil. Is that what you're advocating here?
What I'm telling you is in this particular place, okay, the Chinese have a saying, you know, the mountains are high and the emperor is far, far away. This place is a 10-hour train ride from Beijing. There is not the heavy hand of regulation in this city, I can assure you.
The poorest half of the earth's, you know, an anecdote about China is fine, but the poorest half of the earth's population owns 1% of the world's wealth. The richest 1% owns half of the world's wealth.
Well, socialism is not going to do it for them, Tom. And no bureaucrat in Washington is going to do some regulation that's going to match.
Yeah, they actually bureaucrats in Washington have done regulations that have solved that problem, and it is called changing our tax code. We did it from the 40s through the 80s, Neil.
Well, this tax policy, of course, is a fraud, because what you don't say is that there are fringe benefits. And they're sort of people were receiving compensation that was not taxed. Deferred compensation was part of American life for decades because of the super high tax rates. It's the reason why Ted Williams retired in 1960, but the Red Sox finished paying him in 1980. So 20 years after he left baseball, Ted Williams was still receiving checks from the Red Sox as a dodge from those high tax rates.
Sure.
So people were getting around it. The chief executive's officers were getting around it.
They weren't getting around it the way they are now, Neil. Now, I mean, literally, you have 20 people on Wall Street last year who made more than $2 billion each. There is nothing that you can identify that is worth $2 billion a year. There are people out there saving lives. George Washington Hospital, you got surgeons in there busting their asses, coming in at 4 o'clock in the morning and saving people's lives,
yes,
and they're making $300,000 a year.
But they're not motivated by wealth, Tom. It's not wealth that drives those great men and women saving lives, okay? When I was in the Coast Guard, the guys jumping out of helicopters into those 20-foot seas to save a fisherman, guys I knew who were doing that all the time, they weren't doing it for the free dental. They were doing it because they loved their country and they wanted to help other humans.
Right. So shouldn't we do something about the parasites who just want to suck billions? I mean, these 20 people sucking $40 billion off the top of our economy. You know, the top 1% of America owns 50% of all stocks, bonds, and mutual funds. The bottom half of America owns one half of 1% of all stocks, bonds, and investment devices.
It's very difficult, Tom. You know, when you compare the United States to paradise, obviously the United States loses. But if you're comparing wealth just
to... I'm comparing the United States today to the United States before Reagan.
Where you have families living in the same castles for 500 or 1,000 years. We have a royal family. We have a House of Lords. I mean, what country doesn't have wealth concentrated at the top?
Actually, we have the highest concentration of wealth at the top of all the OECD countries. Of the 34 richest countries in the world, we are at the top in terms of income inequality.
And we have, but what about these countries with royal families?
Most of those royal families are just not as rich as they used to be, Neil. I mean, you know, England has been actually taxing their royal family's properties to the point where they've had to sell off a couple of castles. But we're not talking about England. We're talking about the United States. You know, tax rates for the middle class are pretty much the same as they were in 1960 right now. But tax rates for the highest income.
Social mobility available in this unbridled capitalism, right, is going to be better than the social mobility because of our
social mobility in the United States, Neil, is lower than it has been since 1929.
Well, they still keep coming in, Tom, don't they? By the car.
No, actually, we're seeing net negative immigration into the United States over the last 4 years.
Some of them this summer come over the border.
Yeah, right. Those were children fleeing murder, you know. But and Neil McCabe, GravisInsights.com. Thanks, Neil, for dropping by.
All right, be good, Tom. Bye-bye.
Yeah, you too.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll be back with more mind-blowing facts about inequality, as Larry Schwartz calls it over at Alternet, right after this. And welcome back. Randy, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network in Ottawa, Iowa. Hey, Randy, what's up? Randy, you are on the air. Okay, Randy's on line 9. I'm going to put him on hold here, and you can check out what's going on, Danielle. Drew, in Olathe, Kansas. watching Free Speech TV on Dish. Hey, Drew, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Great. What's up?
I actually wanted to talk about the conservatives are now trying to lob a complaint on Bernie. You heard about this Martha's Vineyard thing?
No, I didn't.
It's a Senate Democratic campaign contribution fundraiser thing, and Bernie was there. But if you look at the article, it in no way, shape, or form says Bernie was going to get any of this money. In fact, I suspect the reason Bernie went there is because the DNC said to him, well, you may not want to take this money. You don't have to take this money, but we want you to come to this event if you want some debates. Because, correct me if I'm wrong, the DNC is the one that controls whether you get a debate or not, right?
Yeah. Yeah, they set the debates.
So,
and they're trying to push them as far off into the distance as they can, I'm guessing is to protect Hillary Clinton.
To diminish his power, I would say.
Well, we're saying the same thing.
Because once you get Bernie into that debate stage, especially if they manage to figure out something with the RNC, with some of these candidates saying we want to, you know, debate a Democrat, so maybe it'll increase our visibility.
Right.
Bernie will shine, I think, above everyone else.
Oh, there's no doubt in my mind. He will blow them away.
And real quick, I wanted to say, next time Neil McCabe is on, could you just mention to him why we've gotten here with the CEOs? This has happened, and this is my own opinion, mind you, since Alexander the Great died, and he was considered to be a god up in heaven when they saw a star up in the sky. And I think we've transferred that god mentality from kings and queens, this divine rule, to CEOs.
Yeah, I don't disagree. I don't.
And it doesn't help that CNBC and some of these networks enable these people. Now, I respect the founder of a company, don't get me wrong, but why are we giving this to people who didn't even found companies, who are jumping from corporation to corporation? Why do we even give them any sort of respect comparatively?
Right. And particularly the guys like Chainsaw Al Dunlop, who make a living of coming into companies and firing 10,000 people and then, you know, walking off with a pile of cash. By the way, apropos of your thing about, what was his name?
Alexander the Great.
Louise and I were in Egypt, and we had a tour guide who was a local anthropologist, and he was walking us around Luxor, and there was an inscription on the wall. He said, this inscription says that Alexander the Great is the descendant of Amen, the god of all gods, and that was how he captured the Egyptians by claiming that he was the descendant of their most ancient god. Amen is the god that, to this day, we end our prayers with his name. And I thought it was fascinating. You know, he apparently got a lot of the world thinking that he was divine, that he was a divine incarnation.
Well, I was watching this special. I think I caught a little bit of it mentioning that that's part of, yeah, how he managed to capture Egypt, was he kind of...
He basically co-opted their religion and said, you know, yeah, I'm the guy. I'm the guy your prophecies told you about. Drew, thanks a lot for the call. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV. We'll be right back. It's 20 minutes past the hour. So a lot going on in the world. I think the most consequential thing going on right now is that the P5 plus one nations, the P5, these are five members of the permanent members of the Security Council, plus China. And so it's England, France, Germany, Russia, us. That's the five members, permanent members of the Security Council, plus China, negotiated with Iran. And it's interesting, China and Russia were part of this. I mean, this is really a multipolar, multi-country effort. And every one of these countries had their own concerns and their own issues with Iran that had to be resolved. And they were able to work this thing out, which is just astonishing to me. And now, of course, the Republicans are going to go on the warpath trying to destroy it because it's, you know, because President Obama had something to do with it, and it's a good thing. So... anyway, we'll see where this all goes. George in Coos Bay, Oregon. Hey, George, thanks for listening to KBBR. What's up?
Hello, Doctor, you're great, and you'll get better. Do you want me to take it off speaker?
No, it sounds fine. What's up?
Okay. I wanted to, in the spirit of anything goes summer, I hate to change the subject from the Iran deal for just a second here, but August 6th is going to be a very important date because it'll be the first Republican debate, and I would like somebody between now and then to start reminding us that it's also a very important date. It's the 14th anniversary of the August 6th presidential daily briefing, where the CIA man came down to Crawford.
Yeah, yeah.
Handed W a file that said Bin Laden determined to attack, and it kind of
inside the U.S.
gave a blueprint. And some months after the attack, it was about a month later that the attack happened, and some months after that, there were some hearings, and Condoleezza Rice had the audacity to say that nobody saw this coming until they handed her that copy of the
PDA, yeah.
That's pretty much all I wanted to say. It's a very auspicious occasion, the 14th anniversary, and I'm sure that nobody in the Republican field will be mentioning that.
That would be a great setup question. You know, that would be a great, basically what you know, in the media business you call a news hook, to use.
You know, his brother will be there.
Pardon?
His brother will be there, and he won't be, you know, he's had a lot of different answers to whether or not you would invade Iraq.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Remarkable stuff. Okay. Thanks a lot, George.
We love you here in Coos Bay, and keep up the good work. Thank you very much. Go Bernie.
There you go. Thanks, George. Great to hear from you. Barry in Chicago. Hey, Barry, thanks for listening to WCPT. What's up?
Hey, Tom. I just have a question, and I would really appreciate your insight if you can help me with this. You rightfully condemn Republican candidates for going to the Koch brothers' home and auditioning for them to solicit funds.
Actually, no, Barry, I don't. I don't condemn the candidates. I condemn the Supreme Court decision that changed the laws that were passed by our elected representatives and signed by our elected president that would have prevented this. And the system is broken. Any candidate who is doing what is lawful in order to get elected, I have no problem with. Whether it's, you know, Scott Walker being the wholly owned creature of the Koch brothers. I mean, there's now this campaign calling him a puppet for president. And in fact, when he made his announcement yesterday, this group flew an airplane over the top of it, which the news failed to pick up, trailing a banner saying that Scott Walker has a Koch habit or a Koch problem, K-O-C-H. I don't condemn the candidates. I condemn the system that has put candidates in this awful situation where they have to go on bended knee to billionaires and ask for money.
Fair enough. But you see the system and this money and the need to get this money as corrupting to the system. Is that true?
That's true, yes.
Okay. So that a candidate from our party who does the same thing and, you know, goes to a $30 million hedge fund manager's home and speaks to billionaires and millionaires and transnational corporations supporting their policies, and then gets up in front of us and makes a speech saying she's going to regulate.
Right, you're talking about Hillary.
Agencies.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, she's going to.
I don't want to bash her.
I get it. You know, if Hillary Clinton is going to be the nominee, she's going to be going up against Republicans who are getting hundreds of millions or billions of dollars from billionaires, and you know, you have to fight fire with fire. You really have no choice. And my guess is if Bernie becomes the nominee, I know that Bernie will not tolerate a super PAC and will not collaborate with a super PAC, but that doesn't mean, Bernie can't stop wealthy people on the left from creating super PACs that would run ads supportive of him, which, by the way, is, you know, when the Supreme Court essentially created this thing and the IRS codified it, that was the vision, was that the super PACs would come out of, you know, come out of places that are completely disconnected from the candidate. Now, all the Republican candidates, and I believe Hillary Clinton also, their super PACs are all basically run by former best friends or campaign managers or whatever, so they don't even have to coordinate. I mean, they kind of know, you know, nod, nod, wink, wink, what each other's policies are and what's going on. I think that that's a very, very corrupted system. If Bernie becomes the candidate, he absolutely will not collaborate with any super PACs, and they would have to do it with his disapproval, not just, you know, but But I suspect that it will happen, because the only way that you can fight a billion-dollar campaign is with another $1 billion. Barry, thanks for the call. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
So we'll see how this all plays out. But it's really a tragedy what the Supreme Court, what these five right-wingers on the Supreme Court have done to this country. Welcome back. 28 minutes before the hour. Oh, this is ironic. Wisconsin State Representative Mandela Barnes. He is a Democrat from Milwaukee. He is African-American. And he says in his Facebook page, I'll just share it with you without comment. I think it's, he says, so I go to the Scott Walker rally. And as soon as I get in the door, a volunteer zeroes in on me to ask if I was alone and if I would like to stand on stage. Now, this could have been my moment for comedic, ironic gold, but I kindly declined. Then a few minutes later, I was pointed out by a staff person who recognized who I was, right? This guy is a state legislator, state representative, who recognized who I was and asked me to leave. I went from the top to the bottom before I even knew it. I was like a sore thumb, and it brought about two distinctly different interactions. LOL. Amazing. African-American state legislator shows up at the Walker event. They first come up to him and say, hey, how'd you like to stand on stage? Oh, it's a black person. We can put him behind Scott. It'll be diversity. And then somebody else says, hey, wait a minute, he's a Democrat. And they literally kicked him out of the room. Incredible. Incredible. Oh, my. Randy in Ottawa, Iowa. Hey, Randy, what's up?
Hi, Tom, and glad to speak with you today.
Thank you, Randy. Back at you.
I have to compliment you on allowing the broad perspective and not being just popular pop news of the day. So my point is that the Democrats and this symptom of the Democrats veering to the left to get elected and then coming back to the center as they find out the reality, as Greenspan did to Clinton,
yeah.
that this syndrome that we're stuck in is the progressives like Kennedy, Obama, and even Clinton, but more so Kennedy and Obama, their presidencies were controlled by problems created by the conservative presidents that came before them,
right?
And so
wars and economic crashes. Yes.
Yes. And in the Kennedy instance,
you're talking about John Kennedy.
Yes, John F.
Right.
I saw it was on the Audience channel on DirecTV. It was a documentary that was called JFK, A Presidency Betrayed. And it was about an hour and a half program with a following half hour program behind that really covered what happened through the Bay of Pigs from his inauguration right up until his death,
mm-hmm.
and his assassination. And this neocon, I will say, the neocons and how the conservatives viewed world. Their place in the world and how they manipulated their place in the world has really caused a big detour when we have progressive presidents. So I guess the thing is that I think we're kind of stuck where the Democrats and the progressives are not thinking two steps ahead. And they're not relaying exactly to their history how they've been, how their message has been stolen and how their progress has been preempted by these problems that the conservatives left for them. So I think that there was one other documentary that was about John F. Kennedy that if you view this one after you view the first one, it was called I Killed JFK, and it's on Newsmax. and it is supposedly the guy who pulled the trigger from the grassy knoll.
Yeah.
And it shows about how the CIA was involved as well. So
yeah, it's
between the two.
Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry.
It looks like part one and part two. In other words, where the one documentary left off, the other one picks up and kind of completes the picture.
Right.
And
but what's your
I'm
point?
Really afraid. Well, I don't know. I think I'm kind of afraid that that we won't have a chance for another FDR. You know, that they're willing to. I don't know. I guess
Jack Kennedy was killed by the mob, and he was killed by the mob because his brother was aggressively going after them. J. Edgar Hoover had been blackmailed by the mob over his being gay and living with Clyde Tolson for decades. And in fact, he used to go down to Santa Tropicana's place in Hialeah, Florida, twice a year with Clyde. And Traficante would give them, you know, money to gamble and put them up in a fancy room and had one-way cameras and had footage of these guys having sex with each other and with other people. And he was being blackmailed. There's no shortage of good books on this. The Man in the Red Dress is probably the best one by Anthony Summers, and who I know. He's a brilliant writer. And he also wrote the definitive book on Marilyn Monroe as well. But prior to 1960, there had never been more than about 30 prosecutions of organized crime in the United States. And prior to 1960, or 61 really, the FBI refused to refer to the mafia as the mafia. According to J. Edgar Hoover, they didn't exist. Robert Kennedy came in as Attorney General, and he was on a tear. He was so angry and upset about organized crime, and in my opinion, it was because he saw he was also very upset with his father, and he saw his father as being part of organized crime, and you know, this is kind of like the son reacting to the father. I think there's something very Greek tragedy about this. That he started prosecuting these guys and had Carlos Marcello arrested, and actually not even arrested, they kidnapped him and flew him down to Guatemala and dumped him in the middle of the jungle, and took Marcello 3 days to make his way out and make his way back to the United States. And you know, he swore he was going to kill Bobby Kennedy, and that ultimately Bobby Kennedy was the one that they really wanted to get, but they figured out that, you know, in order to get Bobby Kennedy, the best way to do it would be to get his brother. But there were over 700 prosecutions of organized crime in 1961, about that many in 62 and about that many in 63. These guys had their backs to the wall, and so they lashed out the way that they do. I mean, how does the mob kill people? They do it with guns in public, and that's exactly what happened. If the CIA had wanted to take out Jack Kennedy, all he would have had to do was put something in his drink. He would have died in his bed. He was sick to begin with. He had Addison's disease. They could have overdosed him with one of his medications. If they wanted to humiliate him or destroy him politically, they could have busted him easily with any one of a dozen different women that he was, you know, hooking up with. I mean, there are this just had mafia written all over it. So.
You're right. It did have mafia written all over it.
Yeah. And by the way, those guys both, you know, lived a long life. Marcello eventually went to jail, but I don't believe Traficante did. And the guy who was in the jail cell with Marcello, Jack Van Lanningham, is still alive. And he's, you know, the FBI has tapes. I mean, we know about these. The FBI tape had Jack had a radio in his cell. He was Marcello's cellmate. He had a radio in his cell, and Marcello was getting demented. He was getting Alzheimer's as he got older, and he started telling the whole story of how they killed Kennedy, and it's all on tape. The FBI's got it.
I'd like to hear those tapes.
Yeah.
But there is more to the story. I think there's more coming out as time goes by. And I don't think it's a coincidence that these documentaries are all coming out about this time.
Yeah.
I think that there's going to be other points of view, and there's going to be small tidbits added to the narrative, I think.
Oh, sure. And the biggest part of the narrative is how they covered it up, which is by convincing Lyndon Johnson that it was Castro who had killed Kennedy. And therefore, LBJ, in order to avoid World War III, dragged Earl Warren in and said, "You got to cover this thing up." And that's why Earl Warren walked out of that meeting with tears running down his face, because he was, you know, the head of the Supreme Court, and he was going to have to do what he had sworn all his life he would never do, which is, you know, violate his oath and everything he believed in by covering up you know, the murder of the president of the United States. Anyhow, Randy, I got to move along, but thank you for the call. Jeff in Tiffin, Ohio. Hey, Jeff, you wanted to respond to Neil?
Well, yeah, that one guy that talked about how great China was.
Right.
We never see how what the conditions in the factories are.
Right, or in the prisons.
Yeah, those factories over there, they're United States factories. There are factories that used to have jobs over here that are over there, and they're state-run over there. And see, I'm work in Findlay, Ohio, and there's a corporation in Findlay called Cooper Tire.
Mm-hmm.
And the Chinese kicked out all the Americans in their one big Cooper Tire factory in China because they didn't want to be taken over by the Indians because Apollo Tire was going to take over Cooper Tire.
Hmm.
So when they talk about China, so that guy talked about China so great, he doesn't know what he's talking about.
Well, yeah, he's been there and he's seen it, but like you say, you don't see the prisons. You know, it's not obvious that if you try to form a workers' union, you know, an employee union, you go to prison. It's illegal. There's only one union. It's the Communist Party, you know, official union. I mean, there's just, yeah, China's problematic, shall we say. Jeff, thanks a lot for the call. We'll be right back. Bob Ney with the Talk Radio News Service will be with us in 5 minutes. Stick around.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Back to the Talk Radio News and your calls as we go through the program here today. Stick around. Welcome back. Ken in Linwood, Washington. Hey, Ken, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up?
Oh, thank you very much, Tom. I'm a big fan. But I'm wondering, I feel a sense of futility every time I sign one of those petitions to overturn Citizens United. It's going to take, I believe it takes like two-thirds of the states to overturn, to make a constitutional amendment.
Yeah, it's two-thirds of the two-thirds of the House and Senate and three-quarters of the states, I believe.
Oh, well, there you go. And I don't see that as anything that's going to happen. I think the only way that it can be addressed is by changing the court and you know, electing a Democrat and getting some liberal justices in there. I see that as the only solution.
Yeah. Maybe. My concern, Ken, is that if you got some liberal justices on the court and they overturn Citizens United, they'd only go halfway. And we need to do this as we the people. The movement is growing, and by the way, it's a bipartisan movement. You've got Tea Partiers and conservative Republicans, and you've got, you know, progressive Democrats and mainstream Democrats, mainstream Republicans. I've talked to Republican members of Congress who are sick and tired of the fact that they have to spend all their time begging for money. You know, it's a little easier for Republicans to do it than Democrats because they've got more billionaires on their side, but it's still an enormous hassle for them. So I would not be as despairing, Ken, as you. I am not as despairing about that. In fact, I will predict that within 5 years we will have a constitutional amendment that will say corporations are not persons and money is not speech, that will overturn Citizens United, because it's you know, over 500 communities now across the United States have said, here's, you know, have agreed to this. I think it's 20 states now have passed resolutions, you know, agreeing with this idea. So, you know, keep at it. Keep promoting it. It's entirely possible. We, you know, when 18-year-olds, when the vote, you had to be 21 to vote, and we were in the middle of the Vietnam War, and Barry McGuire's song Eve of Destruction came out with that phrase in it, you know, you're old enough to kill but not for voting. We introduced in, as I recall, March of actually, got it right here. We introduced in March this, you know, an amendment to the Constitution that would have, where did it go here? Poll taxes, disability, suffrage for 18-year-olds. Okay, it was proposed on March 23rd, 1971. It was ratified on July 1st, 1971. That is what? March, April, May, June, July. That's like 4 months is all it took. because there was a national consensus that if you're going to conscript, if you're going to draft 18-year-olds and send them off to die in Vietnam, that they should at least have a say in the electoral process. They should be able to vote. It took 4 months. That's all it took. So once the popular sentiment hits a critical threshold, and I think that we're getting closer and closer to that every day, as people see, you know, like the Koch brothers pulling together $800 million for Scott Walker, you know, this kind of stuff, or whoever they're going to give it to, this kind of stuff is causing average Americans to say, wait a minute, there's something really fundamentally wrong here. There's something terribly wrong here. And then we've got some, you know, very good voices out there pointing this out, including Senator Sanders, but I think, you know, right across the board. So I'm actually very optimistic, Ken. I really and truly am. Thanks a lot for the call. It's 10 minutes before the hour. We'll be right back. Before the hour, welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and let's check in with the Talk Ready News Service, talkreadynews.com, and brought to you by ghostfortheoldgoat.com and free-don.org. And Bob Ney, author of Sideswiped, is on the line with us. Congressman, welcome back to the program today.
Thank you, Tom.
So what's going on in the world?
Well, of course, we have Iran, and that'll be focused on for the next month, the reaction on Capitol Hill. From Speaker Boehner, John McCain, Senator McConnell, all on the Republican side, of course, is, you know, capitulation, et cetera. But they really haven't, except for Lindsey Graham, they haven't said, you know, they're going to be able to stop this. A simple vote could do it, but they would have to have 290 votes in the House to overturn a presidential veto and 67 in the Senate. Now, Lindsey Graham, who, of course, is running for president, is saying, you know, they're going to stop it. But
right. Talk is cheap.
Really good luck on that.
Yeah.
I did want to mention some important issues. First of all, the Highway Transportation Bill has been renewed only to December. And the reason I mention that is because $8 billion was put into it. So the headline today will be, you know, Highway Bill temporarily, you know, commissioned. But the problem is, Tom, that to dig into this thing, the states will not be able to plan what they're going to do on highway work and do the cost engineering projects, laying out the detail work. In other words, every month this goes on of something that really shouldn't have happened to be temporary is going to cause a complete nightmare affecting possibly years and years down the road of our nation's infrastructure.
Why are the Republicans doing this?
It baffles me because this is a win-win. The only person that ever fought this bill was Andy Card, chief of staff to President Bush, Bush 43. He fought this big time in the House when I was there and lost because a crew of Republicans just absolutely, you know, pushed back at the White House. And that was because Andy Card wanted to strip all prevailing wages out of any bills like this. So you do get some conservative Republicans who want to strip prevailing wage. You know,
as Scott Walker just did yesterday in Wisconsin.
Well, yes. And so therefore, you know, you've got people in a very delicate job because it's potentially, you know, dangerous work, obviously has to be done well, and you have to pay to do that. And if you strip prevailing wage out of government projects, you're asking for nothing but safety problems for the public and the workers all the way down the line. I think anybody recognizes that that's rational on this issue. So that's part of it behind there. They would love to do a deal where they could strip out prevailing wage.
Wow. Wow. But, okay, what else?
Scott Walker, as you said, did announce. It was kind of a lackluster announcement. He went right down the right wing speaking.
Yeah, again. I saw his speech, Bob, and I thought this guy is, you know, do not underestimate Scott Walker. That was a hell of a speech that he gave, and he had memorized the entire thing, and it came off as if he was just talking off the top of his head. And
right.
I think that this guy has the charisma of Ronald Reagan and the mental processes of Richard Nixon. I think he's very dangerous.
Well, and the thing out here that, and I talk to consultants both sides of the aisle that, you know, ask me what I think about different, you know, races and things like that. And, Tom, you know, people can make fun of Donald Trump all they want. The fact remains Donald Trump is running the Republican primary. And once he puts Jeb Bush under, because right now Scott Walker is ahead of Jeb Bush in Iowa, Donald Trump is breathing down Jeb Bush's neck. And I believe once he really pushes Bush down, then Walker becomes even more prominent because Bush will be really secondary to two or three of them that are running. This is going to be a fascinating race, and you can't cannot underestimate Scott Walker. And just because of some controversial stances in Wisconsin doesn't mean he's not potentially, you know.
Well, you're talking to my conspiracy theory. Have I shared this with you?
I think I know what you're going to say, but go ahead.
This is from Newsmax, March 21, 2015. A large group of Republican presidential hopefuls will gather for lunch at billionaire conservative David Koch's oceanfront mansion in Palm Beach. Scott Walker, Chris Christie, Bobby Jindal will be there. Jeb Bush was not there, and Rick Perry was not there. And real estate mogul Donald Trump, who is one of the donors, is also scheduled to attend the event. And so I'm seeing, you know, Donald Trump's a billionaire. These guys are all billionaires. I'm seeing the billionaires sitting around, and they're going, you know, we really don't want Jeb Bush. Scott Walker's our guy. So how do we get Jeb Bush out of the way? And Donald Trump raises his hand and says, I'll do it. You know, I'll run for president and I'll bash Bush. And he has been bashing Bush just mercilessly. And he has said nothing that I can find negative about Scott Walker. The closest he got to it was when he was asked about Walker. He said, well, Wisconsin's got some problems, but he didn't mention Walker by name. And here's the other weird thing. Corey Lewandowski, who is Trump's campaign manager, served as the New Hampshire state director of Americans for Prosperity, which is the Koch brothers' organization. Then he became the East Coast regional director of Americans for Prosperity. And then he became the national director of voter registration for Americans for Prosperity. So you got the Koch brothers basically running Donald Trump's campaign. I think the whole Trump campaign thing is just to take out Bush.
Now, I have to not be part of this conspiracy. I have to give a disclaimer here. Years and years back, Corey Lewandowski ran one of my campaigns. So just so you know.
Oh, really? Interesting. Interesting. So he's a hired gun.
Well, I picked him because we had almost been defeated in 1996, and I found out of hundreds of resumes, he was not all involved at that point in time with all these groups, I found the toughest person I could find, and it was Corey Lewandowski, and he ran our 1998 campaign. Later on, went to work for all those groups, so I saw with interest. When I saw this, I thought, wow, yeah. Trump was serious because he picked somebody who's got this whole linkage. But, yes, after that, Corey had some linkage to the Koch brothers and Citizens, what was it?
Americans for Prosperity.
For Prosperity. And I've often wondered why Trump is not attacking Scott Walker. And really, what Trump is doing to Bush is benefiting everybody. Now, maybe the Koch brothers think, well, okay, let Trump do this, and then once Bush is out of the way, we'll just walk in with Scott Walker and put Trump under.
I think so. I think Trump will withdraw. I think that he is part of this. I think that he is, you know, he's there to take down Bush, and he's looking forward to it and relishing it. But I don't think he really wants to be president. I don't think he wants to work that hard.
Well, I think it's a fascinating scenario, and when I saw that he had hired Lewandowski and some other people, frankly, from the Hill, I thought, okay, he's very, very serious about this.
Right. Very interesting. Bob Ney with the Talk Radio News Service, author of Sideswiped. Bob, thanks so much for being with us today. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And I used a few of these stats from Larry Schwartz's piece over on Alternet today when debating with Neil McCabe in the 1 hour ago right now. And I just want to share the rest of this with you or some more of this. I refer you to alternet.org for, you know, the whole thing. But he points out between 1946 and the mid-70s, productivity in America grew by 104%, and so did wages. Why? Because the unions demanded that. Hey, you're getting more productivity, you're making more profit, you pay our wages more. But that was the end of that. He says, combined with the rise of Ronald Reagan's conservative revolution at home, accelerated the long and painful contraction of the middle class. So now in 81% of American counties, The median, now this is household income, so it's typically two wage earners. In 81% of American counties, the median income, about 52 grand, is less than it was 15 years ago. This is despite the fact that the economy has grown 83% in the past quarter century and corporate profits have doubled. American workers produce twice the amount of goods and services as 25 years ago, but are actually making less than they were 15 years ago. The amount of money that was given out in bonuses on Wall Street last year is twice the amount of all the money earned by minimum wage workers in the United States combined. That's just Wall Street. The wealthiest 85 people on the planet have more money than 3.5 billion others. The average wealth of an American adult is $250,000 to $300,000, but that includes Bill Gates and the Koch brothers and the Walton family, who are worth hundreds of billions, or over $100 billion. You know, he references the old joke about, you know, you've got nine guys in a bar and you know, with an average wealth of $100,000 each, and Bill Gates walks into the room. The average wealth now has become, what, $3 billion, $5 billion, something like that? But if you look at the median, which, you know, is sort of the average of the average, you know, it accounts for those outliers, the billionaires. The median per adult number is only $39,000. That's how much wealth the average American family has, or American adults, placing us 27th in the world, behind Australia, most of Europe, and even small countries like New Zealand and Ireland. They're wealthier than we are. Italians, Belgians, and Japanese citizens are wealthier than Americans. The poorest half of the world's population owns 1% of the world's wealth. 50% of the people own 1% of the wealth. The richest 1% of the Earth's population own 46% of the world's wealth. In the United States, the poorest half of the United States own 2.5% of our country's wealth. This is 50% of America owns 2.5% of our wealth. The top 1% owns 35% of all the wealth in the United States. The slice of the national income pie going to the wealthiest 1% of Americans since the day that Ronald Reagan came into office has doubled. The 1% also takes home 20% of all the income in the United States. 50% of all stocks, bonds, and mutual funds are owned by the top 1%, whereas the bottom 50% of Americans own only 0.5% of stocks and bonds. So much for thinking that a 401k is going to save you, right? While taxes on working people are pretty much the same as they were in 1960, taxes on the top 1%, the highest earning Americans, have gone from on an almost 70% tax rate down to around 35% today. Corporate taxes have dropped from 30% in the 1950s to under 10% today. The top marginal rate is still 30%, but what they actually pay is around 10%. And it goes on and on. I mean, this is just these, and it's not like, you know, I'm peddling envy here. This is not good for a country. It's structurally a bad thing when wealth is concentrated like this, because it takes money out of the productive economy. When billionaires have money, they stash it, right? They put it in the stock market, which inflates the stock market, or they put it in bonds, which makes it unavailable for recycling, as it were, or they put it in Swiss bank accounts, like Mitt Romney has. When working people have extra money, they spend it, which, you know, makes the economy go well. So this kind of inequality actually harms the economy. Something FDR told us all about. Joe in Phoenix, Arizona. Hey, Joe, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call. I'm a longtime listener, and I have nothing but respect for you, and thank you for helping keeping me sane for so many years.
Thank you.
I just have a couple of quick statements and then a question, and I'll just take it off the air. That way I won't talk too much. But anyway, what you said about Kennedy, my father was a pilot and he used to fly people, I guess it would have been back in the 50s, down to Cuba. And that's the only other time I really ever heard that about, you know, who, I'm sure, you know, other people said it, but they started messing around. Cuba was their playground.
The mob ran Cuba.
Down there. Yeah, and, gambling and everything, and that's what happened. And I was just...
Yeah, then Castro kicked him out.
And other than that, I'm an over-the-road truck driver, and I do about 15,000 miles a month, coast to coast, north to south, east to west. And, there's so much of this country where you just hear nothing. I'm actually from Phoenix, so and our 1480 station has been taken over pretty much by sports now.
Mm-hmm.
But, there's so much of this country, you just hear nothing but doom and gloom. And then the religious bunch saying how they're being persecuted by Obama.
Right.
And I have great faith in people, and I believe that if they had the right information, they could make better choices,
Yeah, our media has been, largely absorbed by several very, very large and very, very conservative corporations. And so, surprise.
There's two places or just a handful of places where I can get anything, that's why I went to Sirius Radio.
Yeah.
Thank God for them.
Yeah, I agree.
And other than that, how did Scott Walker get reelected?
With a lot of money from the Koch brothers.
Just the advertising and everything?
Yeah, I mean, it's also how he avoided getting kicked out of office. The Koch brothers and other billionaires just poured an enormous amount of money into his state. Do you have that clip of the spoof ad or the spoof call? We'll dig it. We'll dig it out. You couldn't find it? Oh, yeah, okay, it's not handy. We'll play it later in the day. When Scott Walker thought he was talking to David Koch, and he was like, oh, thank you so much for all your help, all this stuff. And I've been saying this for years now, that Scott Walker is going to be the guy who runs for president. Scott Walker might even be the guy who becomes president. And that Scott Walker has been groomed by the Koch brothers and other billionaires because they know that he will do their bidding. He's just absolutely committed to power. He's got Richard Nixon's mindset, and he's been really, really well trained. I saw that speech he gave yesterday when he announced his candidacy, and it didn't sound so good because his voice is not a wonderful resonant voice like Ted Kennedy had, for example, or Jack Kennedy for that matter. If you watch him, it was just. I was so impressed and frankly frightened, or concerned, because he came across so well. He has been so well groomed. He's had the best and the brightest, the most expensive out there teaching him how to do this. And he's been a politician since he was 18 years old. He's good at it, which is scary stuff. Joe, thanks a lot for the call. Great to hear from you. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Anything goes summer here on the Tom Hartman Program. Back with your calls after this. Welcome back. Janet in Demarest, New Jersey. Hey, Janet, what's up? Janet? Okay, let's try Scott, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network in Canaan, Maine. Hey, Scott, can you hear me?
Hey, Tom.
Hey, what's up?
Hey, I don't know. I want to get your opinion on. I kind of hope Bernie gets it. I mean, I really hope he gets it. But in order for him to be effective, we're going to have to get rid of a whole lot of Democrats and a whole lot of Republicans. I mean, everybody has their favorite they vote for, Democratic, Republican, whatever. Then people got to go, those career people. Pussy, I mean, a bunch of them. They just got to go, or they're going to stand in the way, and they're going to do exactly what they did to Obama. They're just going to defeat him at every corner.
Yeah, I don't disagree.
Get anything done, and so I really would like to hear you say something about that every day, just to start driving it in people's heads.
Yeah, this election coming up is not just one of the most consequential elections of my lifetime, certainly, of the 64 years I've been on this planet. But because the Supreme Court is in the balance, and whoever's in the White House gets to pick who goes to the Supreme Court. but it's also extraordinarily consequential because, you know, a third of the Senate is up for re-election and 100% of the House of Representatives is up for re-election. And if Democrats can take back those two bodies, and there's a good chance they'll take back the Senate, there's twice as many Republican seats being defended this year as there are Democratic seats, then you know, we could actually start moving this country forward and getting things done and putting back together America's middle class. On the other hand, if the Republicans prevail, they're, you know, we're going to continue on this road to neo-feudalism. And I think that that's an absolute disaster, you know, whether it's Bernie or whether it's Hillary or whoever, you know.
I would hate to see Hillary, Jesus, but I would love to see Bernie in there. But I think if you were to say something about, even if it were only 3 minutes a day,
I'm going to
start getting it in people's heads that, like, so if you get Bernie in there, that's not going to be enough. You've got to change the whole thing.
I agree.
You've got to get people in there that's going to work with him instead of stand in the way. Otherwise, you know.
Yeah. Well, keep in mind, it was the crash of 29 that in 32 propelled FDR to the presidency. And, you know, lacking a crash, I don't know how activated people are going to be. I mean, we'll see. How much pain are Americans in right now? You know, do they realize how badly they've been screwed, especially young people? Do they realize how badly they've been screwed? I think young people are starting to figure out, even though they have no institutional memory of what America was like before Reagan, they do know that their parents and grandparents never had student debt, and they do. And $1.4 trillion in student debt. And they know that this is not normal for America. And so, you know, they're getting it that they've been screwed. So there's all, you know, there's all these different dimensions of this, Scott, that I think could come together and be a perfect storm in 2016, against the banksters and you know, we'll see. FDR was swept into office. Not only did FDR win, but the Democrats took an overwhelming majority in both the House and Senate. And, you know, boy, I hope that's what happened in 2016. Scott, thanks for the call. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV. It's 20 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. You remember back a couple, 2-3 years ago, some guy got, you know, called up Scott Walker's office and said that he was David Koch. And they say, what? It was a radio show? Ah, okay. And they got right through to Scott Walker's office. And here is the conversation that hilarity ensued, as they say.
An interesting idea that was brought up to me this morning by my chief of staff. We won't do it till tomorrow. Is putting out an appeal to the Democrat leader that I would be willing to sit down and talk to him, the Assembly Democrat leader, plus the other two Republican leaders, talk, not negotiate, and listen to what they have to say, if they will in turn, but I'll only do it if all 14 of them come back and sit down in the state assembly. They can recess it to come back over and talk to me, but they'll have to go back there. The reason for that is we're verifying it this afternoon, but legally we believe once they've gone into session, they don't physically have to be there. If they're actually in session for that day and they take a recess, this 19 Senate Republicans could then go into action and they'd have a quorum because they started out that way. So we're double checking that, but that would be the only, if you heard that I was going to talk to them, that would be the only reason why is we would only do it if they came back to the Capitol with all 14 of them. And my sense is, hell, I'll talk. If they want to yell at me for an hour, you know, I'm used to that. I can deal with that, but I'm not negotiating.
Put a baseball bat. That's what I
do. I have one in my office. You'll be happy with that.
Right. This was when remember when the Democrats actually left the state? Because Scott Walker was trying to push through, as I recall, this was the right to work legislation, right to work for less legislation. Here's another clip of Scott Walker thinking that he's talking to David Koch.
Now, who can we get to budge on this collective bargaining?
Well, I think in the end, a couple of things are, one, I think the paycheck will have an impact. Secondly, one of the things we're looking at next, we'll probably announce in the next day or two, we've been working with our Republican leaders in the legislature, is we're still waiting on an opinion to see if the unions have been paying to put these guys up out of state. We think there's at a minimum an ethics code violation, if not an outright felony.
Well, they're probably putting hobos in suits.
Yeah.
That's what we do sometimes.
Well, I mean paying for the senators to be put up. I know they're paying for these guys to be in. No, you can, I mean, people can pay protesters to come in. I mean, that's not an ethics code. But, I mean, literally, if the unions are paying the 14 senators, if they're paying for their food, their lodging, anything like that, we believe at a minimum it's an ethics code violation, and it may very well be a felony misconduct in office because, see, technically, it's not just a political contribution. It is, if they're being paid to keep them from doing their job, we think that's there's legally an obstruction, not of justice, but an obstruction of their ability to do their job. And we still got the Attorney General's office is looking into it for us.
Huh, interesting. You're hearing the inside of Scott Walker's brain, right? This guy is a very, very, very canny politician, a very slick, I'm telling you, he's Richard Nixon with the charisma of Ronald Reagan. Here's another clip.
Now, you're not talking to any of these Democrat bastards, are you?
There's one guy that's actually voted with me on a bunch of things I called on Saturday for about 45 minutes, mainly to tell him that, well, I appreciated his friendship and he worked with us on other things, tell him why I wasn't going to budge. Mainly because I thought he's about the only reasonable one over there. And I figured if I talked to him, he'd go back to the rest of the gang and say, you know, I've known Walker for 20 years. He's not budging.
Now, what's his name again?
His name is Tim Cullen.
All right. I'll have to give that man a call.
Well, actually, in his case, I wouldn't call him, and I'll tell you why. He's pretty reasonable, but he's not one of us.
Really? He's not one of us. He's not one of us billionaires and shills for billionaires. Remember I keep telling you the Republican Party basically has three groups of people in it. It's got the billionaires. It's got the paid shills for the billionaires. And it's got the dupes, the people who were duped into voting Republican. By the paid shills. Harvey in Berkeley, California. Hey, Harvey, what's up? Harvey? Boy, Harvey's usually pretty good at listening to his phone. Harvey, if you can hear me, I can't hear you. Call us back. Steve in Chicago. Steve, can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Can you hear me?
Yeah, go for it.
Yes, I want to make a couple of points. And one, I think you raised an interesting point with regard to this sort of conservative narrative in terms of, you know, why it is that you have these disparities in terms of the wealth and income, especially in terms of what average workers are making, given that we've had such large increases in productivity. You know, and they will come back with the notion that, well, you know, as an employer or a corporation, we've invested in technology, and it's not really you workers that are being more productive. It's just that the technology is allowing us to be more productive.
Right.
You know, and again, to that, I think, you know, we do need to be able to respond.
Well, the simple response is if you had no workers to run that technology, you don't have any product or any profits.
Right. Exactly.
Share the wealth. Please.
We don't have a society in which technology can do everything that human beings can do. And by the way, most of that technology was developed as a result of the public sector and public tax dollars going to places like universities.
You're right.
Where technology gets developed and then it gets manifested in a commercial way that you can buy up and that you can apply. But, you know, when a research scientist at Harvard develops a microchip that allows for commercial application, you know, but guess what? A lot of that money came from taxpayer dollars and grants. It came in the way of tuition that the federal government subsidized.
Mm-hmm.
3 out of 4people working in high tech in this country who make that possible went to school predicated upon taxpayer dollars. So, you know, don't let them sort of sell you this, you know, well, you know, we paid for the technology and that's where it ends, you know,
right.
Sort of limited narrative. And I did want to, you know, perhaps disagree with you with regard to the Kennedy assassination. I mean, to date, I mean, the evidence that the mob definitively did it or that there's this preponderance of evidence is as lacking as any other theory. I mean,
I disagree. I would refer you to our book, Legacy of Secrecy. You will find.
And again, I
over 2000 footnotes.
Exactly, and I can point to numerous other works. I mean, Nova did a wonderful piece on this. I mean,
yeah.
Walter Cronkite, Peter Jennings. I mean, I can go on and on. I mean, when Dutch Schultz wanted to assassinate Thomas Dewey, Dutch Schultz, a middle-level gangster in New York, the mob had him taken out.
Yeah.
So imagine the mob's attitude with regard to assassinating the president.
Yeah. Well, it could be, Steve, but read my book and we'll talk. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
It's 28 minutes past the hour. We'll be back with your calls after the news at the bottom of the hour. Stick around. Welcome back to your media support group for We the People, talk media for the sane among us. Charles in Gallatin, Tennessee. Hey, Charles, what's up?
Nothing much. What's up with you?
I'm here. You got something on your mind?
You were talking about the Pope, and you had a caller called in and kind of bashed the Pope a little bit. But if you're reading the Gospel of James, it plainly tells us, you know, that that the rich are, they're hoarding their money. They're not, back in that day, they were not paying people for what they were doing. And also, you know, in the Bible, it says that you can't serve two masters. You can either serve money or the Lord.
Right.
You'll love one and hate the other. And, you know, these Republicans have come up with a prosperity gospel, and it just, you know, it amazes me. These people claim to be religious, these Republicans do, and it really amazes me.
Yeah, yeah. They have turned Christianity inside out. I am convinced that if Jesus came back to earth tomorrow and walked into particularly one of these churches where the preachers are using Republican talking points, he would be astonished, horrified. He'd be driving them out of the temple. Charles, thank you. You're right. The Pope is right on the money. Capitalism is destroying us. Thank you. Thank you very much for that. Daniel in Hinsdale, Illinois. Hey, Daniel, what's on your mind? Thanks for listening to CPT.
Hi, Tom. Thank you. I was born and raised in Argentina.
Mm-hmm.
I've heard and read about Pope Francis when he was Jorge Mario Bergoglio.
Right.
And what he says now is basically what he has said all along. He's a very consistent and cogent man whose life and thinking have always gone hand in hand. So there's nothing lost in translation here, Tom. So maybe some conservative Catholics, they need to face up to their contradictions between the faith they proclaim they have and the way they relate to others and the way they run their lives. Don't blame translation and languages for that. What the Pope is saying today is exactly what he has said all along when he was speaking only in Spanish.
Okay, so Dan, you're referencing when I was debating this with Neil McCabe. He said, you know, I'm not sure that's exactly what the Pope said, and that might have been translated by some liberal or some, you know, words to that effect. And you're saying, no, the Pope back when he was the Archbishop of Argentina, for that matter, started out as a parish priest there, I believe.
Absolutely.
He's always held these positions.
Absolutely. I'm an atheist, Tom, and this man has totally impressed me all along, not because I can relate to what he believes on. I'm impressed by the consistency and his compassionate and the way that he has lived his life in Buenos Aires all along from priesthood on is exactly what he shows today.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree, Daniel. I do. In fact, I've got a picture of the Pope right behind me on the. You can't see it in every camera shot. Yeah, oh, there you go. There's the Pope right there. Anyhow, he's. But Daniel, thank you very much for the call. I'm with you. I think that this guy, I think Francis is the real deal and the first real deal Pope in my lifetime. Anyway, Daniel, thank you so much for calling. Janet in Demarest, New Jersey. Hey, Janet, what's up?
Hi, I was calling. You were speaking of Hillary and the Glass-Steagall Act earlier.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to let you know there was an article in the New York Times today of her vision of the fairness economy. And apparently Alan Blinder is helping her shape her proposals. He had advised President Clinton.
Right.
And apparently he told Reuters that she would not reinstate the 1933 Act.
Right. This is from an article by Peter Schroeder in yesterday's New York Times. Actually, the 13th.
Actually, it's by Amy Chozick.
Okay, we're looking at different articles.
By Amy Chozick.
Okay, this one, maybe this isn't the New York Times article, but I'm looking at the clip of it over at Democratic Underground. It says Alan Blinder, a former Federal Former Federal Reserve official now advising the Clinton campaign told Reuters Monday that she has no plans to push for the return of a banking law that separates commercial and investment banks. Liberals frequently argue that the Glass-Steagall Act, whose repeal was signed into law by President Bill Clinton, would have helped minimize the damage of the last financial crisis. But Blinder, who worked with in the Clinton White House as well, said that that is not in the cards for Hillary Clinton. Quote, "You're not going to see Glass-Steagall," he said, adding that he had spoken directly to Clinton on the issue.
Right.
So that's disappointing, but it's not a deal breaker. I mean, she also came out and said that she's going to start prosecuting banksters when they commit crimes. I think that's a big deal. That's a huge break with the Obama administration, and certainly the Eric Holder, lack of any prosecutions of any banksters. So,
I agree.
Step by step.
That is disappointing.
I'd rather have an imperfect Hillary than Scott Walker any day. Any day. So thank you very much, Janet, for the call. Good to hear from you. John in Cayucos, California. Hey, John, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how's it going?
Good.
Hey, I just wanted to disagree with your take on Scott Walker's speech yesterday.
Okay. Did you watch it?
I watched like the first half hour.
Mm-hmm.
And to tell you the truth, I got very bored. I thought it began awkwardly. I thought he had no charisma. And you're right, although he did memorize it, it sounded like it was memorized to me.
Hmm.
It sounded just like it was just delivered, it was delivered. I thought it was delivered poorly. I'm like, thank God he doesn't deliver speeches like Ronald Reagan.
Yeah. John, I hope that your read on Scott Walker is the one that most Americans hold to rather than mine.
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, I'm scared as hell.
Yeah.
If he becomes the president.
Yeah. David Koch ran for vice president of the United States in 1980 on the Libertarian ticket on a platform of privatizing Social Security, doing away with Medicaid and Medicare, ending unemployment insurance, doing away with the minimum wage, right down through the list. Bernie's got it posted over on his website. I need to find it and print it out again. But I mean, this is the modern Koch-fueled Republican Party. All these Koch heads,
yeah.
and the head Koch head right now is Scott Walker. And
yeah, you're right.
Yeah, it's scary stuff.
Can I say one more thing?
You may.
I just want anyone that doesn't know this already that Bernie Sanders has an app you can download that's free. And you can look at all the most current press releases and everything else like that.
No, oh, really? There's a Bernie app?
Waste paper and print them out. Yeah.
Is there a Mac version of it? I mean, an Apple version?
Well, I got it on my iPhone.
An iPhone version? Oh, yeah. You've got it on your iPhone?
Yeah.
So you got it out of the App Store.
Just go to the App Store and type in Bernie Sanders, and there it is.
Okay.
I actually was reading it. I just typed in, I typed in Bernie Sanders press release. It came up, and when I was reading it, about 3 or 4 seconds into it, a little button came up, popped up at the bottom of the iPhone, and it said, if you want to install the app. And I said, yeah, you're damn right I do. And I tapped it, and it goes to your home screen, and boom, there it is.
Huh.
It's awesome.
What's the name of the app? Shane is in the App Store right now trying to find it.
I think it's just I think it's just called Bernie Sanders, or let me see if I can bring it up real quick without hanging up on you.
Yeah. Yeah, put me on the speaker and then you can.
Let's see here.
Because Shane is not finding it.
It's on the screen. Can you still hear me?
Yeah, I can. So the name of the app is
Senator Sanders. And it's a little gray thing that has his name in it.
Okay, Senator Sanders. All right, cool.
Yeah.
You found it, Shano?
The senator is abbreviated.
Okay, Shano's going to track it down. John, thanks a lot for the call. Harvey in Berkeley, you want to try it again?
Sure. Hi, Tom.
Hey, Harvey.
Well, going along with the transfer of America's wealth to the wealthy,
yeah,
I'd like to talk about a scam that the Republicans use to deliver our commons to the corporations. And in 1988, at the Republican National Convention, George Bush said, quote, read my lips, no new taxes. But right. One thing you'll never hear Republicans talk about is no new inflation. And in 1930, you can get a full breakfast for 30 cents, and now that costs $5 or more due to inflation. And the cost of everything goes up, the cost to run cities and towns with no new taxes, our municipalities have to lay off police and firemen, cut social programs for the youth, for the elderly, cut food programs, cut services. So they essentially go on the card, they start borrowing money and paying high interest rates, and then they have to pay the penalties, and they get into a lot of debt, and then they have to sacrifice, like, the locally owned waterworks,
right,
some outside corporation. So that's how the Republicans deliver the commons to the corporations.
You're right, and it is a scam. And the one thing that's missing from your equation, Harvey, is that wages have not been keeping up with inflation or with productivity. And had wages been keeping up, were we earning twice as much now as we were 40 years ago, then the tax collections would have gone up as well, even though the rates wouldn't have gone up, and you wouldn't need to raise taxes. But the reason that they need to raise taxes is because wages have been stagnant, and you're absolutely correct. The cost of running government and everything else has been going up. So it's really a two-pronged problem. One is the suppression of wages by Reaganomics over the last 40 years. And then the second part is the no new tax pledge, which means that you've got to cut government services. You're absolutely right. A great analysis, Harvey. Thank you. It's 15 minutes before the hour. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We'll be back with your calls right after this. Welcome back. 15 minutes before the hour. John watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV in Bozeman, Montana. Hey, John, what's up?
How you doing, Tom?
Great. What's on your mind?
Great. Hey, I want to just I grew up in the belly of the beast with John Bircher, evangelical.
Whoa.
And this whole thing of capitalism, which has a very predictable end to it when you run it out to its end, and people that are brought up believing that the earth is going to end in a scary apocalypse with blood up to the bridles of horses,
right.
These two things together, I really believe that all of these politicians that are coming out with these worldviews, they should have to state right out front where they're getting their stuff from.
In other words, the politicians who are – well, what politicians are talking about the end of the world?
Well, Scott Walker, let's take him for example. He left his father's Baptist church because it wasn't strict enough for him and went to a kind of a Pentecostal-based church. Right. Now, is that somebody with that type of worldview – is that somebody that you want running the country and making decisions as far as, you know, nuclear wars and our economy is concerned?
If you know, I've been in Pentecostal churches, and I have no problem with somebody who is Pentecostal being president if they're as clear about the role of religion and government as Jack Kennedy was. I mean, Jack was an observant Catholic, and he said, in my personal life, the Pope is going to call the shots. But he didn't say this literally, but in effect, this is what he said. But in my role as President of the United States, the Pope has no say whatsoever.
Right, but the exact opposite is happening now.
Oh yeah,
they are coming out and they're coming right out and saying that they're going to take their theology and it's going to be plugged right into the way they govern.
Oh, I know. And now you've got we did the story. I think it was Thursday or Friday of last week, about this guy who has he used to be a Bible salesman, and now he's got a new hustle. He's teaching pastors how to do politics in church, Republican politics, of course, in ways that won't endanger their nonprofit status. And they're running classes all over the country for pastors on how to prepare your congregation for the 2016 elections. And I mean, this is not. You know, you were talking about politicians being religious. This is the religious, trying to influence politics. Both sides of that equation, that teeter-totter, are dangerous, in my opinion. And Ted Cruz is the other one that's a little spooky, John. Have you seen the video of him being anointed by his father, who's a pastor?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you could go on and on.
They really think that he might be the reincarnation of John the Baptist, the guy who's going to come back and be the precursor to the return of Jesus.
He's very good at standing behind his father and looking nonplussed while his father makes all kinds of insane announcements.
Right.
And he's made a career out of it as a politician. You watch him when he's standing behind Sarah Palin or anybody he happens to be with. He won't give a cue with his facial features, and then when he gets up and it's his turn to, you know, speak his piece, that's when it really comes out. He's very good at playing his cards close to his vest.
Yeah, yeah. But Ted Cruz is a smart guy. I mean, you don't graduate Harvard Law School if you're a dummy, which is what makes him all the more troublesome, shall we say, to the future of American democracy. John, thank you for the call. We'll be right back. For the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Dave in Los Angeles. Hey, Dave, what's on your mind? Dave in Los Angeles? Okay. Dave's on line 6, if you want to check that out, Danielle. Ray in McHenry, Illinois. Hey, Ray, can you hear me?
Yeah, hi, Tom.
Hey, what's up?
I think nuclear, maybe bounce this idea. I think nuclear weapons have prevented many wars throughout history since we've had them. Because if we hadn't had nuclear weapons and that hanging over our heads, I think we would have probably gone to war with Russia and a lot of other people since then. And that's why I can't understand why everybody's so paranoid about Iran getting one, because it's going to continue to operate that same way, because they would be committing suicide to ever use one or let a terrorist group get a hold of one.
You know, I don't, in principle, I don't disagree with your argument. And in fact, given the fact that Israel has a fairly substantial nuclear arsenal, Iran having nuclear weapons, it would just, you know, it'd be the Mexican standoff, mutually assured destruction, right? MAD. And there's something to be said for that. On the other hand, the proliferation of nuclear weapons is like really a scary thing. There, as technology advances, every major war we've had has always used the newest technology, every world war. Whether the newest technology was nuclear weapons, which we used in World War II, or whether it was, you know, poison gas, which was used in airplanes, which were used in World War I, whatever the newest technology is, it gets used. And so if we go into an all-out world war, I'm very concerned about all these nuclear weapons that are running around. And this is one of the things that scares me about what's going on between the United States and Russia around Ukraine and our putting NATO troops into Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia and Poland.
Quick thing I also wanted to say, you know, I once got in a fight in high school, and my wrestling coach told me something I'll never forget. He said, don't ever get into a fight unless you expect to get hurt. And we seem to not take that advice. The Republicans are talking around like we're going to kick Iran's butt and they're going to sit there and take it. Well, we wouldn't take it, so why would you think they would?
Right. That
it's just look what it's,
yeah, that was George Bush's thinking about Afghanistan and Iraq, and then look at where it got us. That's a great one, Ray. Thank you very much for the call. Dave in Los Angeles. Let's try it again.
Hey, Tom.
Hey, Dave.
The last two days I heard you reference and play some clips from that prank call to Scott Walker from the radio station.
Right.
There's a more important point in that call, and it really reveals his whole strategy. Later in the call, he refers to his bathroom revelation during a Super Bowl about how Reagan was made famous and popular by going after PATCO and going after the air traffic controllers busting the unions, and that's when he decided to do the same. He admits that in that call. But it's quite obvious, I watched his whole speech yesterday, that Walker's campaign is going to be running as the reincarnated Reagan.
Yeah.
Reagan too.
Oh, yeah.
But here's the thing. Reagan, when he ran, all of these ideas and concepts had not been tried. The Laffer curve, trickle-down economics, and all the others, the deficit spending. But they've all been done now, and they have a track record, a proven track record of failure.
Right.
Best way to go after Walker is go after Reagan and those myths, just like that caller on Rush Limbaugh's show did, and showed what Reagan really was, and Limbaugh had no answer.
make Walker defend these policies and Reagan's record.
Yeah.
Be the best way to go on this.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right, Dave. I don't know about the call to Rush Limbaugh, but I agree with you. I absolutely agree with you. Thanks for the call. Fred in Silver City, New Mexico. Hey, Fred, what's up?
Hi, how are you doing, Tom?
I'm well, thank you.
Can you hear me?
I do. I hear you fine. Fred, you're on the air. Fred, can you hear me?
I want to make a point about Bernie Sanders.
Okay.
And the point is, hello?
Yeah, keep talking.
Yes.
Fred, can you hear me? Okay, we got a problem with the phone here. Fred, I think Fred has a problem with his phone. Fred, call back, you know, tomorrow, and we'll try it again, okay? Stanley in Chicago. Can you hear me, Stanley? No? Okay, David in Indian Trail, North Carolina?
Yeah, keep talking.
David?
Yeah.
No?
Fred, can you hear me?
I hear you, but it sounds like you're underwater.
Stanley.
Okay, so apparently we're having Comcast troubles again, you know, when all our phones go out. David, you're going to have to call back tomorrow, too. I'm really sorry. We are going to be moving out of this building. The only Internet provider we have here is Comcast. We've got three Comcast business lines coming into this place. And, you know, we use a voice-over Internet protocol phone system, which requires a reliable Internet connection. And tragically, we have found that our Comcast service here is extremely unreliable, shall we say, at the very least. So we're going to be, this is July. We are going to be moving in September, in August, actually. Yeah, and about 4 weeks and so when we do. So anyhow, I want to just, okay, we got one more on the board if we want to try it. Stanley. Hey, Stanley, you're on the air. Can you hear me? Nope. Ain't working. David in Indian Trail?
Yes, I was just going to see, you know, they talked a lot about Bernie. What is his stance? Because I've never heard anybody say on gun control.
Bernie has, he's got a D or somewhere between a D and an F with the NRA. He has, I believe, supported things like the assault weapon ban and closing the background check loophole. He's a little more states' rights-ish about gun control than many Democrats. He comes from a state where there is no gun control in Vermont. When I lived in Vermont, you can walk into a gun store, buy a gun, stick it in your pants, and walk out. You know, no big deal. And they have a very, very low murder rate, they have very few problems with guns in Vermont, even though there's a lot of guns there because there's a lot of hunters. So his take is that, you know, Chicago should be able to do what Chicago does, and New York should be able to do what New York does, and Vermont should do what Vermont does. So, and I don't disagree with that. I think it's a reasonable kind of middle ground that you would think even the NRA would support, but who knows. Anyhow, thanks so much for being with us today. We will be back tomorrow. And in the meantime, don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It actually requires all of us to participate, whether it's participating in a message board or getting involved, you know, Progressive Democrats of America, PDAmerica.org, whatever it may be. Get out there, get involved, tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit TomHartman.com.